Hi, I'm Johnny De La Rosa, and I'm a third-year bioanthropology major.
Hi, I'm Elena. I'm a third-year, and I'm a social science major.
And today, we will be talking about anthropologist and writer Zora Neale Hurston. So Zora Neale Hurston was born on January 7th, 1891 in Alabama. She had seven siblings and then moved to Eatonville, Florida at 1 year old.
So, as Johnny mentioned before, Hurston and her family grew up in Eatonville, Florida, where she experienced the virtue of being surrounded by positive Black excellence throughout her life, such as her father, John Hurston, who was a preacher and had involvement in the town hall. He had also been reelected three times as mayor, and her mother, named Lucy Potts Hurston, directed a Christian curricular at a Sunday school. This led Hurston to believe that she was also destined for greatness, just like her parents. But at the age of 13, her mother passed away and her father began a new marriage, which he ended up giving more attention to that marriage instead of her, leading her to feel as if she was alone without support. And because of that, she ended up moving to Jacksonville with her brothers, but ended up struggling to finish her education. And sometimes they wouldn't even support her. One of her brothers had kids, and he kind of just wanted her to babysit. And when all this was happening, she also ran off a second time with two dramatists named Gilbert and Sullivan, and she ran off with them as the maid to the lead singer. So with their influence, she also wanted to become a person who writes plays just like they did. But her connection with them ended up coming to an end in 1916 in Baltimore. So further then, at the year 1917, she decided to finish her education with high school and enrolled herself at Morgan Academy and even pretended to be a 16-year-old. So she minimized her age by 10 years. She was 26. But she did this for Baltimore's tuition-free educational system. She ended up graduating in 1918 and continued to enroll herself at Howard University. Her involvement here she got a lot of recognition because of her charisma, and she met and got close with a bunch of influences such as Lorenzo Doe Turner, who taught her African vocab, Montgomery Gregory, who directed her as a member of the Howard Plays, Alon Locke, who encouraged her to publish work in the Howard University journals. She met many more writers who would also collectively, including herself, become a part of the important history of the Harlem Renaissance. As she progressed, she was insisted on by others to move to New York, where she eventually found herself in Harlem. Zora naturally decided to then dedicate herself to advocating and informing the world on her readers about Black culture and African American rights, causing a great influence on generations amongst Black writers as well.
Wow, that was really interesting. Thank you, Elena. So now that we have some background information on her, I would like to talk about her importance and some of her important writings. One of those writings was called Their Eyes Watching God, which was fieldwork in the Black South in 1937, where she collected songs and folklore in Florida and Louisiana, where she not just was an objective observer, but in her fieldwork, she embedded herself in the Black communities as a participant, using an effective method created by Malinowski. Little did she know, by using this method, she would open up doorways to many ideas and experiences. So to give a little background into this, her primary research was on African religions. She helped pioneer the future direction in the field, which is important to anthropology as she highlights the methodological challenges of employing anthropology as a discipline for her study. She contributed significantly to the foundation of research on Black religious spiritual traditions in Haiti, Jamaica, and the southern U.S. during the early 20th century. Her writings in anthropology are richly innovative for research on African religions. She concentrated on inherent structure and logic of Haitian voodoo itself, which made her a pioneer as an anthropologist. Studying the African religions, by giving voices to these religions, it was safe to say that her methodological approach sought to unearth the profundity of the holism and the traditions she studied, rather than focusing on the mere statistical ideas like data. She was one of the first to document the religious phenomena of African religion and spiritual traditions transitionally. She had the ability to analyze and record without added dimensions of marching research. It was said that she provided and still provides a template for transdisciplinary research. She sought to think beyond and outside of dominant theoretical framework. But at the core of her contribution to anthropological study of Africa religious traditions and subjectivities would be her prowess as a methodologist engaged in participant observation and artistic theorist. It was said that her artistic edge and work demonstrated what it really means to be a medium whose goal was to convey the message from other realms. She practically created and forced us to take seriously the spirit and all its technological capacities. As a source for producing knowledge as an ethnographic tool for her legally demonstrates the profound depth of the spirit as a subject of anthropological inquiry. She also sought to employ decolonized methods in anthropology, but faced challenges like past and colonial heritage. It's sad to say, but back then, anthropology and its research methods remained rooted in colonial dynamic. Some other important things that she had done, too, was she brought many questions to anthropology and opened up other gateways for future anthropologists to think about and to answer. But taking a quick little break, something interesting that I found while reading was that Franz Boas was her advisor, but even though he was her advisor, he was very constricting on her, and thus despite encouraging a thorough scientific investigation of the cultures of African descended peoples through the Americas, Hurston's work and academic training was constrained externally by the demands of a specific belief in how scientific research was to be conducted.
Stringing along from what Johnny said, Hurston wanted to work under Franz Boas, but there was a stumbling block. There weren't enough classes for Hurston to continue in her special field at Columbia University to debrief on African diaspora in the Americas, because majority of individuals who studied anthropology involved themselves with specific Indian studies. Hurston had completed a study on Floridian work that Boas was not content with because he insisted on her following through with an ethnographic report, which was a qualitative method for collecting data often used in the social and behavioral sciences, not a collection of folklore. So he considered her to try and be a spyglass of anthropology, which was a metaphor Hurston used about Boas' perspective on what he wanted her to do for him. She then left Florida and went to Harlem despite failing Boas's expectations, since he didn't have much interest in Black studies. The Negro movement was a rightful representation of Black individuals to the public eye, which had been one of the motives that drove Hurston to appear in Harlem once again. Hurston met Langston Hughes, who introduced her to his benefactor, Charlotte Osgood Mason, to provide Hurston with a motion picture camera. With Hurston's dedication, Boas was impressed and assigned her to the South to inform herself about the beliefs and dances, songs and folklore on Black individuals, as Johnny has touched as well. On this assignment, she had a mission to document the Negroes furthest down. She shared and voiced a former enslaved man who was also the oldest living named Cujo Lewis. And his African name was, I don't know if I'm going to pronounce it right, but it's Owawi Kosola. She shared and voiced his story in her book, Barakun, The Story of the Last Black Cargo, and remained using African vocab for the authenticity, even when publishers wanted it to be translated, but she refused. She just didn't want to lessen or weaken Kosola's voice. The book was published in 2018 and became a bestseller. Here's also another important individual named Alice Walker, who rediscovered Zora Neale Hurston. Even when, after years had passed, there was no recognition of her work until Alice Walker had brought light into it. Zora's reputation dispersed by the time that she had passed, which was in 1960, and Alice Walker brought light into Hurston with a published article/essay in Miss Magazine named In Search of Zora Neale Hurston, or also named as Looking for Zora. She saved Hurston's grave spot and purchased a proper headstone she deserved. I have come to know Zora through her books, and she was not a teary person herself, but partly, too, it is because there's a point at which even grief feels absurd. All Walker felt was her mission was to revitalize Horsten's work, since she couldn't do it herself any longer, and ignited her being once more, causing the acknowledgement we know today. Horsten became a step for African American writers, and like her gravestone says, she's a genius of the South.
So overall, I think it is safe to say that Zora Neale Hurston was an amazing anthropologist, writer, pioneer, ethnographer. Despite being faced with so many challenges, she laid foundation that will forever change the way we as anthropologists think. Even though she was just recently recognized, it certainly won't be the last. Well, guys, I hope you guys enjoyed. Again, I am Johnny De La Rosa.
And I'm Elena Hernandez.
And thank you guys for tuning in.